So just a few minutes for a review of what we have covered and then what we're going to get in today. On the first day, remember, we looked at why this subject of alcoholism is so important and gave you a handout on facts related to alcohol, alcoholism, the impact that it has upon society, upon the world, and even upon Christians, upon the church. We looked at what God says about alcohol abuse in His Bible, that drunkenness is sin, the misuse of alcohol is sin, and through abuse of alcohol over thousands of years, it has become a curse for many people instead of a blessing. And we looked at what God's Word says about the proper use of alcohol, that God created it to be that blessing. And so we covered the scriptures, you know, showing and proving that God created alcohol. He created grapes and the fermentation process and intended it to be a blessing and to be used as a blessing. We reviewed that. The theology of alcohol, that it is okay to drink if you're not addicted to alcohol, if it's not a problem in your life. And then we talked about alcoholism versus alcohol abuse, beginning to understand the difference between someone who may just be a heavy drinker, an alcohol abuser, I maybe call them a drunkard, the difference in that person than approximately 10% of the population in the United States that would be called a true alcoholic. And a true alcoholic is a person whose body cannot properly metabolize alcohol, and they become addicted to it. We went into what's wrong with the body, the problem with the liver, the other things with metabolism. There are many factors involved. And we saw a film by the former chairman of the National Council of Alcoholism explaining some of these facts and factors. And he also made the statement that not only is alcoholism can be genetically inherited, that there is a predisposition in some people through genetics, but that you can also trigger alcoholism through the abuse of alcohol. Misuse of alcohol can trigger alcoholism in a person. And then yesterday, we went a little more deeply. Myrna spoke and told her story about her struggle with alcoholism and how God intervened in her life and helped her and her whole life in the church, growing up in the church. Glenn told his story the day before. My story is one of not the alcoholic, but that would be an entirely different subject someday, and that is the children of alcoholics and how it affects you growing up in an alcoholic family, how it affects you emotionally, what it does to you, and how to deal with that. That's another entire subject we'll deal with hopefully sometime in the future, and that is the children and the families of alcoholics. And then yesterday we went into more deeply the definition of alcoholism. We recognize that for some people calling alcoholism a disease is a cop-out, that they feel that means they're not responsible, but they are. All alcoholism is, when you describe it as a disease, it enables you to treat the person. It enables the medical profession to save their lives. And we handed out the definition of alcoholism. And this has been the result of decades of research and study and has been established by the American Society of Addictive Medicine. So I understand the concerns that many have. That's why sometimes I say, well, if it's hard for you to accept it as a disease, think of it as an illness or a sickness, maybe like diabetes rather than cancer. You know, some people cannot handle sugar either. So we went into that in more detail about the alcoholic is a sick person who needs help when they become addicted to alcohol. Today, we're going to focus on what do you do to help the alcoholic? How can you help them if they can't help themselves? If they're on that downward spiral of addiction and denial, and they deny they have a problem, and yet their whole life is out of control, what can you do to help them? And so I'm going to now introduce Myrna Leisure, once again, this happens to be one of the areas of her expertise and her experience in the field of alcoholism. So Myrna, if you would come on up, and we're also going to see, when Myrna is finished, we're also going to see a very, I think, interesting film about Alcoholics Anonymous.
All right, as Denny explained, we've reviewed the theology, we've looked at the problem, and today it's the good news, and that is there is a solution. And I believe that the only long-term solution is found in the reasons that you're here at ABC. The only long-term solution is the return of Christ and the second resurrection and the healing power of an almighty God because of the magnitude of the problem. I realize that today all we can do is kind of scratch the surface of the problem. And there are people that come to me and realize I work in the field and they say, well, how do you deal with the failures? How do you deal with the percentages of people who don't make it? Because more people die of alcoholism than recover. And what I like to focus on is not those who don't make it, but there are those who do. There are those who recover and get their lives back and are productive, responsible members of society. And for me, that's the focus and the goal and what keeps me fueled is, yes, you can see the sparkle in their eyes as they begin to regain some health and they begin to grab on to a solution. You know, and I believe that's what is, you know, paramount in my mind. If we had the answer and we could just open up the mind of an alcoholic and pour in the solution, we wouldn't have had the staggering statistics that you were looking at on Wednesday. If it were that simple, we'd just say, okay, here's a course of action, you follow it, ba-da-da, you're cured. Then we wouldn't have the issues that we do surrounding alcoholism. It's just not how it works because it's such a complex problem. So we're going to look at the solution. Sue asked yesterday, so what do we do? What if you love someone who's an alcoholic? What if you know someone's an alcoholic? You know, what if you're my poor husband that got stuck with me? You know, that wasn't his plan either, as Denny said. He didn't marry me thinking, oh, great, this is what I'm going to be dealing with in our 30s. That was not Everett's plan either, trust me. But what if you are in that position? The first possibility when you're speaking of an alcoholic is that person may actually get a moment of clarity, a spiritual awakening, say, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. They may come to you. They may go to their pastor. They may go to their physician and say, what can I do? That does occur. That does occur. That is rare, but it happens. In that case, the steps for treatment are the same as the next scenarios that I'm going to give you. One other scenario that would come about would be perhaps that someone would be in a work environment where they had a workmate, they had a supervisor, someone noticing their performance, they were absent on Mondays and Fridays a lot, etc., and would say, there's something wrong here. They were shaky, you know, perhaps bloated from their alcoholism, but especially their work performance began to fall, began to decline, they weren't as effective. And so there's oftentimes in this area, there's a program called EAP. In some of the larger unions in this country, like the American Auto Workers, et cetera, EAP is Employee Assistance Program. And those are very common, and the EAP personnel know about the insurance plans. They know about resources in their community for a variety of issues, from marital counseling to personal therapy to alcoholism. And I've seen people, for instance, with Southern California Edison, referred to treatment as a result of a qualified EAP personnel. then they're the ones that follow the person's progress so they can keep their job. The next one may be a legal consequence, which is becoming more and more common as the blood alcohol level is reduced in terms of drunk driving. So the person may get a DUI, driving under the influence, drunk in public. In some cases, it can be as a result of a violent episode, which we talked about, and that spousal abuse. The police are called. Somebody's under the influence, and they are arrested as a result of that. And very often, the judges will say, rather than incarceration, you need this. And they'll give the person, the first time, a chance at treatment. The last one may be something called an intervention. And the most famous intervention that I can think of, for those of you who, many of you maybe weren't around to remember, but that was Betty Ford. And what happened was that former President Ford and his children and her doctor and one of her best friends got together with Betty, and she's in her bathrobe and she can't figure out it's not her birthday, it's nothing important. What are all of these people doing in my house out in the desert near Palm Springs? And it turns out they were there to say, hey, this is what has happened to us as a result of your drinking. So we're going to look at these, specifically the last one, more in depth. I want to stress that I think a casual intervention is dangerous, and it can very well end up killing a person. If you just decide one-on-one, I'm going to talk to somebody because I don't want to embarrass them. I'm going to go up and say, you know, Glenn, I've noticed your performance is going down, and did you ever think you might have a problem with alcohol? One-on-one, Glenn's going to look at me and say, you're absolutely nuts. It's not affecting my life. It's none of your business. A casual intervention is dangerous because the people involved don't necessarily know all of the steps necessary to take. A formal intervention has specifics. The specifics of a formal intervention, the first of all, is that you consult a qualified professional. There is a society of intervention specialist therapists in this country. They aren't everywhere, but nevertheless, you could probably consult a physician or one of these resources. You also have some hotlines out by the phone in the front that would also begin to give you some ways to do this. Usually, a minimum of 5 people involved in the alcoholic's life are utilized. Family members, co-workers, friends, perhaps even your pastor. Those people discuss among themselves with the professional. They refine how they have been affected by the alcoholic's behavior. And what is important is that they assess how has the alcoholic's behavior affected them. In other words, it's not a pointing the finger, you this, you that, you da 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 da. It's, I feel this way. I couldn't bring my friends home because I didn't know if you were going to be loaded. You can imagine President Ford when his wife would end up at state dinners under the influence. It's I statements. You know, that's the important thing. They don't assess blame, but they state painful facts about the alcoholic's behavior to cut through the denial and to precipitate a crisis in the alcoholic's life. If Denny and I and Glenn's wife Connie and perhaps a close friend and his children were all in the same room saying, Dad, I feel this way because of your behavior. His wife says this. Denny says, I think your performance, you know, we can't count on you to be there to perform a wedding, to perform a baptism, whatever is necessary. We never know when you're not going to be available to us. It's real hard for Glenn to say, you don't know what you're talking about, to 5 or 6 people. It's very hard to deny it at that point. A treatment option is determined before the alcoholic is ever confronted. You check into the insurance opportunities that you may or may not have. Do you have insurance that covers chemical dependency? If so, does it cover detox? How long of a treatment option does your insurance plan cover? Do you live in a country that has socialized medicine? If so, what options are available to you? All of this is done before you confront the alcoholic. You leave nothing up to chance. You don't confront the alcoholic and say, oh, now we're going to wait and see where we can find to put you. You don't give that person a chance to back out. Okay? A time and place for the intervention is determined, preferably when the person is not under the influence. You cannot get through to a chemical. You cannot communicate with a chemical. You think you're communicating with a person. You are not. You're communicating with a chemical. Can't reason with a chemical. Nothing. And the treatment plan is implemented should the individual consent. Now, you know, I explained to you what Betty Ford, what her experience was. I also am the product of an intervention. Sue asked about yesterday, what can you do to help precipitate a crisis to get the alcoholic into treatment? That's what occurred with me. My husband consulted a qualified professional. He and my children were taught what to say to me. Another friend of the family that had been involved in some community groups was there. A treatment plan was available to me at that time, and they then went about the process of the intervention, and I went into detox and a 28-day program. And, you know, they followed through on the words that they had to say. And just to give you an idea, I explained to you some of the things that might have been said to Glenn. What was said to me was that my 9-year-old daughter at the time looked at me and she said, Mom, how could you be so selfish as to not get help when it's there for you? I don't know what anybody else said except for my husband, who said there was a bed for me. But I know what that child said. My son still doesn't remember what he said either. But it's real hard to not go into treatment when you're looking into the eyes of a 9-year-old. That's why you follow the process. You have a goal in mind, and you consult qualified people. Okay? I don't imagine she thought that up herself. Someone helped her come up with that. Okay? What kind of treatment options are there out there? A lot of us are familiar with medical model or a hospital setting. Medical model means that the entire time the person is in treatment, there's ongoing medical care. You know, in the late 80s, when getting treatment, or the mid-80s to the late 80s, was in fashion, there were hospital treatment programs quite frequently, up to 30 days or more. Insurance companies would fund them, and they would often cost up to, say, $12,000 to $15,000 to $20,000 for the stay. And out of that, depending on your insurance plan, you would pay 10% or 20%. Detox is usually covered 100% because it's considered a medical emergency. So oftentimes, 100% of detox is covered. One of the arguments I've heard in favor of the disease concept is, if it's not a disease, how come the hospital just took my $30,000? And that, I know a treatment facility that was the amount. It was $1,000 a day. Okay. Unfortunately, with the advent of HMOs, PPOs, those opportunities for long-term medical treatment are not available. What used to be a 3 or 4 day detox, depending on your physical health and stability, now is oftentimes 2 days. What used to be a 30-day, 45-day treatment program where the therapists and the medical doctors could say, I need this person to stay a little bit longer, now is ended at 12 to 14 days, unfortunately. And one of the reasons is because alcoholics relapse. They do not always get it the first time. You know, it's amazing the amount of money this country spends on the war on drugs and ignores alcohol. And it's an issue in the treatment field. At any rate, a medical model costs between $500 to $1,000 a day. What will your insurance company cover, and what can you afford? Most of us, $1,000 a day is way beyond what we can come up with. Next, we have an option of a residential treatment program, and they can run considerably less, some of them $750 to $1,000 a month. It is a full-fledged treatment program with therapists, qualified counselors, certified counselors on board. Again, when you have socialized medicine, what kinds of options are there for residential treatment? I recently met an individual that was opening a residential treatment program in the Ukraine, you know, for that overwhelming problem in Russia. It can run around $1,000 a month, which is a far cry from $1,000 a day. Mm. And they are usually same sex, in other words, for women only, for men only. There are occasionally co-ed ones. It usually you have the option of 90 days instead of just a minimum of 2 weeks or whatever. One of the things that medical model programs are doing today is they will have the 12 days or so inpatient, they call it, and then you have the option for outpatient and aftercare, sometimes up to a year. And for the entire package, then after the initial 2 weeks, that can run around $4,000 for the year, which is, again, more manageable for the average person, working individual, more manageable. There's long-term residential treatment available that can last from 6 months to a year. One of the best examples of it, some of us would be very surprised about, but it's the Salvation Army. And they run something called an adult rehabilitation center. It's usually for men. Occasionally, they have one for women. The reason that they can operate their residential treatment programs at no cost to the person entering the program is because of the wonderful place some of us as women frequent called their thrift stores. And the people work in the thrift store and in the warehouses in the morning. The afternoon, they go to treatment. And they, again, the Salvation Army does not just utilize clergy or whatever. They have qualified, certified counseling staff. They are non-denominational. They have a Christian approach, but not a specific religion. Okay? The Salvation Army was started because a man in the 1800s in the Midwest, in Missouri, as a matter of fact, wanted to be able to help alcoholics and prostitutes. The particular Protestant faith of which he was a member was not too keen on that population because they didn't tithe very well. So they wanted the money from their constituents and from the people that they were helping, and so he decided to start something else, and it was the Salvation Army. And, of course, they are a giving society of people. They are there in times such as national disasters. But, again, one of their arms is the Adult Rehabilitation Center. And I have seen people come out with quality sobriety and turn their lives around as a result of that 6 months or whatever in a treatment program. Now, some of you are sitting here thinking 6 months to a year, that's too long. I mean, how could a person commit their lives to something like that? There are a couple factors involved with that. One is that if you did get a nudge from the judge, in other words, if you had a DUI, a drunken public, a domestic violence charge, the judge is not going to go for 30 days. Now, he wants something comparable, something to ensure that you're really getting your life together, to a jail sentence. You're getting that treatment instead of jail. And so if you look at it in that way, that sometimes it's in lieu of incarceration. You know, and we as church members are not immune to DUIs. Okay, unfortunately, people are not always wise about driving after having consumed alcohol. In the state of California, it's 0.08. The Kinnevans were saying in Australia, I believe it's 0.05, which is considerably lower. And I know I've seen people get into their cars after leaving a function who had more than one drink in a short period of time and by law would have been considered under the influence had they been stopped. I was at a restaurant not too long ago and I heard two high-class women, very involved in the community, you know, people who held political office in the town where I live, talking about whether or not they should have another drink, and the logic employed was, I don't have that far to drive. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. The other thing about a long-term commitment to treatment is this. Very often an alcoholic has been in the process of getting sick for a number of years, sometimes up to 20 years. 6 to 12 months in terms of a commitment to residential treatment is not very much compared to the time it took the person to get that sick. And what I tell people when I have the opportunity to share with them when they're in my treatment facilities or where I have worked is, it took you a long time to get sick. You are not going to get well overnight. You don't even get physically well. They often say that it takes at least 6 months for the alcoholic's body to come back to some level of normalcy, and oftentimes up to a year. I want to mention at this time, too, is it's extremely dangerous for an alcoholic to detox themselves. You can die easily in the first 7 days due to seizures, among other complications. You have a human body that was born not operating, hopefully, under the premise of alcohol, unless your mother was an alcoholic. And that body has had all of its bodily functions work without alcohol. Over the course of time, when an alcoholic drinks, every function of the body, including brain passageways, learn to function with alcohol, and they consider it the norm. You take it away rapidly without medical supervision. The entire body goes into a shock state and says, we don't know how to act now. How in the world am I supposed to metabolize? Where is the nerve message supposed to go? That's why you see people without a drink like this. We kid around, you never give a detoxing person a full cup of coffee. You only give them a half, because it's going to go somewhere. Okay. You know, one of the best things that I've learned about alcoholics in recovery is we've learned to laugh at ourselves. And we don't laugh at the disease, and we don't laugh at our bad behavior, but we learn to laugh at ourselves and not take ourselves quite so seriously. Outpatient treatment is also an option. What is outpatient? It's oftentimes in the evening, on the weekends, or partial day. The wonderful thing about outpatient is that you may be able to go to work. And again, some insurance plans will cover it. If you are in the process of researching an intervention, find out. Find out. If you're the spouse of the working individual, are you covered under the chemical dependency aspect of the insurance plan? Can you afford outpatient? Should you not be covered under it? If you can work and go to outpatient, are they going to be flexible with your work schedule? Okay. Some medical models, such as hospitals, offer outpatient programs, and you don't necessarily have to have gone to the residential aspect of it. You can just go in for the outpatient program. And again, it's often 6 months to a year. Okay. Some residential facilities, like a long 90-day women's residential facility, they may have an outpatient component to their program that you can come to. There's one men's facility with which I'm familiar. They have night and weekend outpatient, and then they are also a residential treatment program. Outpatient provides the same one-on-one therapy. They provide group counseling, group sessions, and have many of the same opportunities, but you're not medically monitored. There are also those, especially the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, which is all over the country. They're not in every city. They are in many cities. They often will offer an outpatient program. And they usually work on a sliding scale, sometimes as little as $25 a week. And when we're talking again about someone who has had an incident, for instance, a possession charge, and it could be marijuana. And I am not so naive to think that people in the church do not go after illicit drugs. I'm not saying it's the norm. I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying I know that people have. So if you had a possession charge, very often that's not considered as serious, and the judicial system might say, yeah, you can do outpatient. So again, we're looking at, there are a variety of reasons. Sometimes the motives may not be that good, but you can get recovery in spite of yourself. But you can do outpatient. It ranges from $25 a week to maybe four times that. So check into what you have in your area. The last one is a component called halfway houses, three-quarters houses, sober housing or sober living. They're all lumped in together. They used to be commonly used sometimes in the early 60s. They were called boarding houses. It was easier to get a street drunk into treatment in the 60s than it is today. That's why there's so many options. Many of these treatment facilities, if you were to check into them, they have up to a 12-week waiting list of people trying to get help. I've seen people come from the state of New York to the state of California because in New York City, the waiting list is sometimes 2 years long for a quality program. So it's important to find out what your resources are before you start working with an alcoholic so that you can say, okay, until there's something available, let's do this or whatever. It's not a given you're going to be able to find treatment immediately. There's far more people seeking treatment than there are opportunities. In the state of California, in Southern California, there used to be 4,500 treatment beds funded by the state and by the county in the late 80s, early 90s. In that same area, there are now 1,500. So you can see that the opportunities for those trying to get help have diminished. And we were disinherited as a population. An even more disinherited population was the mentally ill. one of the other opportunities in terms of sober housing, they connect it with outpatient, and that is that the person would go to day treatment or evening treatment. They would then go to sober housing for the structured umbrella that sober environments provide. Sober housing is exactly that. It's housing where you can't drink and use. If you do, your opportunity to live there has just been suspended. If it's a good place. One of the big lacks in the field, we were talking about it last night, are facilities for women and children. And again, that has to do with the cost and the lack of funding that we have from the government. Very hard for a woman and a child to get into treatment. Mark, he's not here, but he's worked in a homeless shelter, and he asked me whether or not there was more money available than there was in the early 90s. I would imagine there's less. What do you look for in a recovery setting? What do you look for in an apartment? You know, is it dreary? Is it dingy? Is it dirty? You know, when you walk into someone's house, how do you feel? What's the atmosphere like? Is it tense? Do the people look happy? Does it seem positive? Is it warm? The colors bright and cheery? Is it a place where you'd want to go? And one of the things that I looked for very intensely when we were looking at property for the two houses that I have is, would I let my children live here? If my child can't live here, why would I let anyone else's child? Every one of these people has a mother somewhere, you know. What would their mother think if they came here? I really don't want mad mothers, you know. But some of these people are older than I am, but nevertheless, they've had a mom, you know. And I want a safe environment for these people, clean, where they're not at risk to being hit up by the dope dealer when they walk out the door. First of all, does the program work? Have you heard good things about it in your checking? How many people referred you to this program? Does it work? Do they have a good success rate, or is it a flop house? Is the setting drug and alcohol free? If it isn't, definitely it is not the place for the newly recovering person. And some places say they are, but you do a little talking, you do a little checking, and you find out that it is not. Is there a strong family component? I can't stress this enough. You know, a lot of people in the field feel that the family surrounding the alcoholic gets sicker than the alcoholic. Why would that be? You know, I kid around with Denny that ones that are really sick are the ACAs. You know.
The adult children of alcoholics.
Right, the adult children of alcoholics. I have to give him a hard time. Why would that be? Well, you know what? When Denny was 14, I don't think he was using booze to numb his feelings. He had to deal with everything. He was present mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. He felt it all. The alcoholic in his family had something with which to deal with his feelings. That's why it's so important that there be a family component. Now, my children hated it, but they came. I can't tell you how much they learned. I have no idea. My son turned 14 and my daughter turned 10 when I was in treatment. Is there a strong therapeutic, educational, and peer component? In other words, therapeutic, what that means is guidance from qualified counselors, doctors, etc., if that's the kind of environment that it is that has a doctor. Some residential treatment programs that are not medical model have a good relationship with the medical community, and they have a physician that will come in and help them. What is their educational component? How do they educate the person about the disease and recovery? And is there a positive peer component both within the treatment facility and aftercare? You've learned the value of a peer component at ABC. We were talking last night that your experience here is going to last you a lifetime. Unfortunately, not everyone's going to make it in a sober environment. You know, when I was in treatment, one of the things that they said to us that scared me so badly was they said, look to your left and look to your right. One of you is going to die of the disease of alcoholism. One of you will stay sober. And one of you is going to stay in a living state of confusion, not ever being able to stay sober and not being able to be comfortable loaded. And I'll tell you something, I'd rather die than be in that other category. I am just the one that was fortunate out of the one out of three that by the grace of God and a program of recovery and a support team that I'm sober today. And I realize that. You know, oftentimes if you start counting the number of people, if you're in this field, that die between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I mean, and New Year's, it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. You know, 1 year I heard just personally, just one people coming to me, not polling other people, of 10 deaths of people I knew personally. Do they provide aftercare? I had the opportunity to go to, I could have gone till aftercare until the residential aspect of the hospital where I went closed. Do they have opportunities as an aftercare component for people who went through the facility to volunteer? Because it's good to be able to come back and share with people who are in your chair. You know, when I was in treatment, there was a guy who'd been in my bed. His name was Harry. And Harry brought us tapes on Saturday night for us to be able to watch a video. I wanted to be like Harry so bad. You know, that's what I wanted to do. And I did volunteer in that hospital until it closed. I volunteered for like 8 years. What are the costs? Not just money, but in time commitment, both for you and for the patient, for the alcoholic. What are they going to require of you? What is the belief system that's instilled? You know, is it a belief system that's positive and one of sobriety, of total abstinence? If it's relevant, what are the staff's credentials? Are the people masquerading as licensed therapists and counselors? Do you see licenses on the wall if it's a facility where this shouldn't be occurring? Is it a facility, for instance, in your area that is state licensed and county certified? If so, are those licenses posted? State licensing means that they meet a certain code put out by the particular state. In my state, it's the state of California. They check things like mattress pads, silverware, where you house your soap and your chlorine, how clean is the place. They check the client records. They check that storage of medication. They make sure it meets a certain standard. If it's a sober living facility, is there an agency whose criteria they have to meet? I'm part of the West San Gabriel Valley Sober Living Coalition in my area, which means I've been reviewed by a team of peers in my area who've come through it and made sure that my houses are healthy and safe. Is there involvement in a 12-step program in the 12-step community? I bring this up because the 12-step programs, and I have some of them listed here, Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Pills Anonymous. These are all specifically related to substances. On the other side, I have some that are not so closely related to substance. Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Sex Anonymous. How is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, and again, it's a 12-step program for overeaters. And the last one is Debtors Anonymous. There's also a program for dual-diagnosed clients, and for those of you unfamiliar with the term, dual-diagnosed means a certified mental health illness, and also chemically dependent. There's a specific group of people to go that are dealing both with the psychiatric diagnosis and chemical dependency. One of the reasons that those who are mentally ill use substances is to treat their mental illness, and it's very difficult to find out which came first. Sometimes street drugs are easier to get than psychotropic medication for those who are mentally ill, and in some cases they treat the mental illness better than the psychotropic medication from a psychiatrist with fewer side effects. I am not endorsing the use of street drugs. I'm telling you why the mentally ill use them. I mentioned in the beginning, what do you think of the atmosphere of the place? Is it a place where you want to spend 30 days? If it isn't, why would you put someone you love there? And what is the food like? You know, hospital foods are notoriously bad, but hey, they do the best they can. Those are the things to look at in terms of a treatment environment. I'm going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to pass out a couple things about it. Then we're going to see a film about Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? They're going to be passing out a handout called What is Alcoholics Anonymous? It's a summary. The 12-step spiritual program, both with scriptures and without, of the 12-step community. And a outline that's used within AA of the personality character, or maybe we don't have that one yet. Okay. AA is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. AA is not affiliated with any sect, denomination, or facility, neither supports nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is the preamble in Alcoholics Anonymous. It sets forth its goals and its premise. One of the premises of AA is that experience is the best teacher. AA works for a variety of people caught up in the disease of alcoholism. It's been described as the single most effective treatment for alcoholism. There are 3 million people worldwide in Alcoholics Anonymous in 150 countries. Again, I have put up on the board the number for Alcoholics Anonymous in the Cincinnati area. They also have the special phone access for the deaf. If you had the time while you were here, you could call and ask AA, where is there an open meeting? Open meetings are for anybody to attend. You may find doctors, nurses, people in college programs such as yours attending AA to find out what is it all about. Al-Anon is the family component for those who love an alcoholic. It's called Al-Anon Family Groups. It was started by the co-founder's wife when she decided that maybe she had a few issues around her husband's alcoholism. As a matter of fact, she threw a shoe at him one night and had some choice words to say about him going to another AA meeting. That's when she decided that maybe she needed to start something of her own and learn to deal with her own issues around alcoholism. The premise of Al-Anon is this, that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. The point being is that, I'll use Denny as an example, he's powerless over alcohol no matter what the container, whether it's a close friend of his, whether it's a person in his congregation, whether it was me. And his life can become unmanageable around that alcoholic. Al-Anon would help him deal with his issues. Another group that I didn't put up there is called ACA. And literally, it's Adult Children of Alcoholics. And they use the same 12-step program that Alcoholics Anonymous does. The 12-step program works. Why? Why would it work? Because it's based on spiritual principles. As you will see when this, with the scripture listings, it's based on truth. And truth works no matter what. Works no matter what. For me, one of the best analogies of the first steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, is when the Apostle Paul said, Apostle Paul said, I do what I don't want to do and I don't do what I want to do, in effect. And that is the dilemma of the alcoholic. Getting up in the morning and saying, I'm not going to do that. And he does it anyway. Sin. Sin. There are some resources out there that dovetail the 12-step program with the Word of God. One is called the Life Recovery Bible. And it does not just stick with alcoholism. It sticks with, it utilizes a variety of issues that you can have been found that the 12 steps are effective with, such as CODA, Codependence Anonymous, eating disorders, etc. The 12-step recovery Bible sort of embraces the idea of recovery in the 12 steps in the Word of God. There's another smaller book called Serenity, and it is the Gospels, Psalms, and Proverbs, and again, it can take you through the scriptures as they relate to every step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to stress that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place to abdicate you from responsibility of your bad behavior under the influence. In fact, it does exactly the opposite. You are responsible. And as we briefly go through these steps, I want to show how that is the truth. The second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Why do the 12 steps always come in the plural form? Why? The idea is that the co-founders discovered that alone, I get drunk. Together, we get sober. The idea of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another. The connection is made and recovery can begin, where two or more are gathered together. That's why it's the plural form. You know, Glenn and I have not been together to share recovery, but we click on certain things. We can give each other a hard time, call each other on our issues when it comes to alcoholism because we understand. The barriers are broken as we share. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. There are some people in the Christian community that have a hard time with that as we understood Him. Well, they're not worshiping the true God. I have a couple of points on that. The first one, the most important being, is as a matter of course, the fact that the three of us have been in the church for the same length of time does not mean we have the same concept of God. Our relationship with God is personal, and we embrace that God in different fashion. We believe in the same plan. We believe in the same doctrines, and we believe in the same God, but how we interact with that God varies. And I'm sure that it varies among you. The second thing is that people who are alcoholic have had another God, and it is alcohol. And they're beginning, for many of them, to replace it with something more positive. Some people have come out of a punishing environment when it comes to God. and have difficulty embracing the idea of the Judeo-Christian God. This gives them the opportunity to embrace something till they can come to a relationship with God that's positive and perhaps more along the lines of what we might suggest. The other thing that's important for today, until Christ returns and the plan of salvation is implemented, this gives people around the world with a variety of faiths, whether it be Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, or atheism, to embrace the 12-step program. You know, for me, it's the God of my understanding is the God of the Holy Bible. For a Buddhist in recovery or a Japanese man in recovery, that may not be the case today until God comes back and restores the whole world to a level of sanity where he's concerned. The fourth step is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And, of course, the book of James says that we need to examine ourselves. We confess our faults. That's the next step. But, of course, we know about examining ourselves. And we're told at the Passover that we don't just do it once a year. And a fearless and moral inventory, moral means truthful. You look at your behavior, you look at your resentments, your fears, your wrongs done to others. You make a list of those. Admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, and you have people say all the time, oh, it's enough, I just told God, I'm not going to tell you, it's none of your business. Well, the reason I would go to someone that maybe such as my pastor or to Glenn and share these things is to keep myself honest. You know, and the other thing about it is when I share them with another human being and they look me in the eye and they say, it's okay, I love you. It's a huge relief. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You know, it's going to God and say, this is what I did, please forgive me. This for me is about the repentance. Step two for me is about forgiveness, because I cannot believe that if I am going to be restored to forgiveness, restored to sanity, if I haven't been forgiven, I can't be restored to sanity. You know, and I was taught, how dare I not forgive myself when God has forgiven me? You know, all God was ever waiting for, he already had sent his son, was for me to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, please forgive me. Made a list of all persons we harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, again, to me, this is proof that the 12-step approach does not mean I'm absolved of responsibility about my bad behavior under the influence. The other part of that that's often added is, and what can I do to make it right? This means if you stole from the IRS, you paid them back. This means if you stole from somebody's medicine cabinet, you pay them back. But this also means an emotional amends. One of the amends that I was concerned about was as a parent. And what I was taught was that I could never make up for all of the wrongs in the past. And I have made direct amends to my children. But what I had to do was be the best mom I could be on a daily basis. And I've endeavored to do that for the last 11 plus years. The next step is what we embrace as Christians through prayer and study. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. You know, to understand, I may have acted badly. I shouldn't have spoken out of turn. I'm sorry. And I endeavored to do that today. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, a couple points here is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That doesn't mean I'm about making the inventory for Denny. It's my inventory. You know, I don't need to write down his wrongs. They're my wrongs. And when it says here that praying for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry out, you know, that is what I pray, that God show me how to act as a Christian person today, as a positive person. The last one is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And what the program says is you can't keep it if you don't give it away. You know, and just as, you know, there was someone in a treatment facility that taught me a path, I endeavor to pass that on. These are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can look over the 12 traditions. There are a couple of them I want to highlight. The third one is that, The third tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. In other words, you don't come there perfect, and they know that. The seventh tradition is every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I want to interject here that you could attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because you needed to for the rest of your life and never contribute a dime. This is an organization that is not about money. Now, the flip side of it is to be self-supporting means that when you can, that you give it back. You know, but I've been taught that self-supporting means I clean up after myself, I make my bed in the morning, all the things that we kind of take for granted is also being self-supporting. But I think that it's important to note that. And the 10th one is, will be covered more fully on the film, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. AA believes that its best defense is silence. The final thing here is some criticisms of Alcoholics Anonymous. One is that it's a cult. And that my research into cults is they have one central leader. That is not the case with AA. The other thing is, in Los Angeles, there are over 2,000 meetings per week in English alone. There are Spanish-speaking meetings, Armenian meetings, meetings for the deaf, and now finally some meetings in Russian in Los Angeles County. If it were a cult, I don't think you would have so many options. Okay, the second thing is that it's a religion. Religion is a codified ways of worshiping God. All that AA asks is that you worship God. Another criticism is that there's hugging. And I think that's a positive because alcoholics, when they are in early recovery, do not feel very lovable. There's smoking because many people are addicted to nicotine. There are hundreds, literally hundreds, of non-smoking meetings. And the last thing is the time commitment. And what I would say to that is that you as an individual would not spend nearly as much time in an AA meeting as that you would loaded. So we're going to see a film and then we'll have a break.
Well, after the film, we're finished.
Oh, we are?
Yeah. The film will finish the class. Oh. We're going to be out of time, but we want you to see the film. This was an A&E special about Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you'll learn a lot, hopefully even enjoy it. It might help somebody, give you the background. They're the most successful organization in the entire world to help people with an alcohol problem, and it's free. So that's why we want you to have more knowledge about Alcoholics Anonymous. So take your break whenever you want to. As soon as the film is over, the class is finished.